Dr. Jerry, you got the whole world waiting. Been ready for you to start the conversation. Your point of view, it got the haters confused. Leave it up to you to bring us all the good news. Positive vibes and the sex appeal too. Dr. Andre Jerry, can I get an interview?
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Live with Dr. Andre Jerry, your trusted source for real conversations, practical wisdom, and purpose-driven insight. I'm your host, Dr. Andre Jerry, and we're broadcasting live from San Juan, Puerto Rico. This show is broadcast worldwide in over 128 countries and has featured artists, authors, entertainers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders from across the globe. So wherever you're tuning into from tonight, on behalf of myself and the Artist First Radio Network, I want to thank you for your listenership. So tonight we have a special episode in store for you. And I want to start this by asking a simple question. How many of you out there listening tonight are educators? Specifically, I'm talking about teachers in public schools who carry the daily responsibility of shaping our children in grades K through 12. If you're a public school educator or you have family or friends who are, I want you to call or text them and let them know that this show is on. Send them the link to this show and tell them to tune in, because tonight we're going to have a conversation that has been long overdue. So when we talk about education, we often focus on things like underfunded districts or outdated resources that the students are using, concerns about student performance, but very rarely do we look at the human beings who are standing at the front of the classroom. We almost never ask, how are our teachers doing? What pressures are they carrying on a daily basis? What support do they need and they're not getting? So tonight we're going to explore that side of the story, the part that doesn't make the headlines all the time, but absolutely shapes the future of our children. Joining us for this important discussion is someone who knows this topic intimately. He's a highly esteemed educator, a best-selling author, and he continues to make an incredible impact in his industry. He's here to talk about his powerful new book called Suffering in Bleak Silence, A Teacher's Mental Health Struggles Exposed. So welcome back to the show, my friend, Dr. Stephen Bond. Dr. Bond, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I can't complain. And thank you again for being on your show. I really enjoyed it the first two times, so I'm really excited about being on here again. Thanks again.
Hey, listen, glad to have you here. I'm glad to have you back on the show so we can sort of catch up. And, of course, we're going to talk about your new book. But first, you know, a lot has happened since the last time you were on the show. I think it's been about 2 years since you were last on. I know what's been going on in your world, but do you mind letting our listeners in on all of the exciting things that's kind of been taking place over the past 2 years?
Sure. Well, awesome. Well, one of the things is I did get married in August, and it was awesome. And I know you, if you were able to make it, you would have. And it was just an amazing time. And so along with that, I'm still working and teaching. And the second book about my grandfather did really, really well. Got a lot of accolades for it. And also, I appreciate being on your show, because being on your show really brought the book to a spotlight. And I did a couple of book signings in New York and even North Carolina, and it was just amazing. And just being on your show helped me so much, because I always want my grandfather's story to be told. And his book that I wrote for him is called Unsung But Forever Remembered. And for me, it was important to give his legacy for people to see, because he had a patent for the car turn signal. So that's the clicker, blinker, as we call it today. And he had a patent for it from 1927. And so what was amazing about it, we found his patent. And then that kind of validated his invention, because for years he told people he invented it. And I would tell people, my family members would. And unfortunately, most people are the lie. So having a patent and writing a book about it opened up so many doors for his legacy to be told. And I was on main podcast. I even did a few professional developments talking about him and the inventor and grandpa that he was. So just you being there for me and just being on your show really opened up a lot of doors for me, and I'm just so appreciative even to this day. So thank you again, and while I have you here, thank you again for doing the foreword for my new book.
Oh, I was so happy to get that call. I was excited when you told me about the book. You know, this is the first time anyone's asked me to write a foreword for their book, so I was excited not only that your new book was coming out, but also to be asked to write a foreword for someone's book. That's very personal and special. So I was like, wow, that's awesome. And so, of course, I got to read an advanced copy of it, and I fell in love with the book. So thank you again for that privilege. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you as well. And, you know, like I said before, when I thought about who I wanted to get a foreword, you really was the first person I thought about. And I was thinking when the book was finished, I said to myself, who do I think would really write a good foreword, who knows me and knows how I am as an educated person? And I thought about you. And so when I asked you, I was thinking to myself, well, I hope you said yes. And so I was honored and privileged that you did want to do it. And it was so eloquently written. And so just reading it, I was almost emotional just looking through it. So I'm so grateful for that because, like I said before, when we first did the podcast, I knew you as a person, as a colleague, but now we're friends. And that podcast was so amazing. I had so many people listen to it. I had hundreds of followers and my friends listen to it. And they were just amazed about the story of my grandfather. And they said, the guy who interviewed you, it's amazing. He knows what he does. He talks so eloquently and detailed. And so, you know, after that night, you know, we just continue to grow closer and closer. And I really appreciate our friendship. And like I said, I'm glad I made the right choice with, you know, writing the foreword. And, you know, when a few work for things, one of the things I wanted done was a historical marker for my grandfather. And they told us you had to wait at least 25 years for somebody to pass before he can do a historic marker. And so what we want to do in the town he's raised in is just have a historic marker with his name on it, showing that he had the patent for the car turn signal. That, you know, even to this day means a lot to our family.
Oh, man, that's going to be all. Have that happened already, or is that something that you're currently working on?
No, it has, but we're in the works for it because we had to wait first 25 years, and about a year ago, it came officially 25 years. And so now we can do the paperwork, and, you know, there's a process, there's a time waiting period, but, you know, we hope soon that that will happen. One of the other great things that occurred, too, with the mayor of Windsor, North Carolina, Mr. Hoggard, I met with him and told him about my grandpa's story, and he didn't even know about it. So I met with him a few years ago when the book came out. You know, we had a picture, shook my hand, and he was just amazed about the story of my grandfather because he didn't know about it. And Windsor, North Carolina has maybe 1,000 people, and now most of the people in that town know about his invention. And like I said, the patent, if you go on Google Patents, you probably can see it. Some is still not showing it, but, you know, we have access to it, which is amazing, and we're happy for that. Because, like I said, for years, he was denied by history, but, you know, he was delayed, but thankfully not denied anymore. And that what made us as the Bond family feel relieved about it. You know, he should have been paid and compensated for it, but the fact, at least, that he's not been recognized for it is awesome.
Well, I'm happy that it's being recognized, and I'm happy for just a small part I've been able to play. When I first came across that story, I believe it was from one of your stories or posts on Instagram, because I wasn't on TikTok at the time, and I was kind of captivated by the story. I love stories like that, true historical stories about real people who did things that were often unsung and overlooked. And so I love authors anyway, you know that. And so when I came across your book, I was like, I'm going to reach out to him and see if he would like to come on the show to talk about this book. This is awesome. And so thankfully we were able to connect, and you came on the show a couple of times. I remember the last time I called you, I was like, hey, my guest pulled out. Can you come on the show and give us an update on things? And
that's right.
You were so gracious with your time. And I just appreciate that. I'm glad to see everything's kind of churning and moving, and all of the accolades that your grandfather is now getting for his invention. Because I know that's the story of so many inventors who have patents and, you know, they fail, you know, through the cracks somehow, and other people end up getting the accolades and the financial, you know, things from it. So I'm just happy that he's now getting his just due and that there's been a lot of attention on his story. And that's awesome that the mayor of Winston, North Carolina, has also become aware of the story and stepping in to do his part as well. So it's awesome.
Well, definitely. And thank you. And like I said, what makes the whole thing great is not only were we able to get his story out, but many times on social media, people would DM me and say, Dr. Bond, my family member invented this or invented that, did not get credit for it. And they asked me, like, what process or what steps can you do to try to, you know, at least have them have credit for it? And what I suggested first, and it might be the easiest thing, but first try to get a copy of the pattern, because in the case of my grandfather as well, you know, anytime you pass someone to the U.S. government, they give you a serial number. And so even if that expired, because it's kind of like a driver's license, you know, a driver's license can expire in, like, in most states, 7-8 years. But at the same time, you had a license. So when the patent expired after a while, we still were able to find a patent with the same serial number and so valid. And we did like a Google patent search. Like I said, on some search engines, it'll show and it'll have his name and even a picture of his actual diagram of the signal light, of his explanation for it, and his sign and notarized stamp. And that's important, too, because one thing to have a patent, but when you also have it notarized by the lawyer, which he had, and also signed on the bottom, that validates even more. And so the fact we were able to find the patent and find the signature with it and being notarized, it made it valid. And so there was no denying of that. You know, he may not have got compensation for it, but history tells us David George Bond had the patent for it. And a few years ago, I was on the news in Greenville, North Carolina. And after I did the story, yes, and it was awesome. And here's what he did the next day, Doc. When it was on their website, the fact checkers went to check the validity of it. And the person who got the credit for the signal light, his patent was 2 years after my grandpa's. It was in 1929. And my grandpa, he submitted his application in 1926. And it became official March 1st, 1927. So it was like 2 years before the person got credit for it. And so not only was the story valid, but it also showed that he tried for years to get loans to, you know, renew the patent. He also tried to do some more innovations with it, but he couldn't. And every time he tried to get a loan to renew the license or enhance the invention more, he was denied by three banks in the county he lived in because they knew what he was up to. You know, he was getting threats from the KKK and still persisted. And especially back then in North Carolina in the 1920s, that was just a dangerous thing to do anyway, to be bold. He actually voted in Bertie County in the 1920s. So to do that as an African-American man, that was very risky at that time. So he's not only a pioneer, but he also was an activist.
Oh, man. See, and I'm so glad that you documented all of this in your book. And even everything that's happened since then is turning out to be a lot of validation for your family, the Bond name. And so I'm just excited about it. I look forward to hearing more about this because I think you reached out to me at some point and told me that people were trying to get rights to the story and possibly do a documentary for that. Has there been any more movement on that front?
There's been some. I spoke to a few people because what I wanted to do was even like a short documentary on him. And I spoke to a couple of people who are like movie producers, and one person was a historian in North Carolina, and they know about the whole story, and they're fascinated and intrigued by it. And so hopefully in the near future, there could be a documentary on it because I feel like he owes it and he deserves it. And so I've been talking to a couple of producers about it and how we could do it and just step-by-step how it would look. Because like I said, more important than anything, you know, I want the story told. So not just in North Carolina is told, but worldwide that's told because, you know, pretty much for almost 100 years, the story was denied, and the fact it's now open and people see it is a blessing. Right. Because after this, so many people have told me and said, Doc, my family member went to this, or he had a pass for this, and he never got credit for it. And for so many years, as African-American people, we invented things and never fully got the credit for it. And so the time now is where the whole story is coming out, that we see African-Americans inventing more things that was told. Because like I said, either they kept a secret or they used intimidation or bullying to stop African-American people from getting a patent. And even if they got a patent, they tried to deny them to renewing it. Because they knew you had a pattern, they could try to talk to you and intimidate you. Because, like I said, any U.S. patent number, you put that in and the search engine is going to show. So they kept tabs on it. And so that just made it more dangerous for him. But now it's 2025, and now those stories are coming out in the spotlight of so many people who are inventors and not get the accolades they deserved. And like I said, my grandfather's one of them, and I'm so happy for him because I knew him personally. He died when I was 25. And so we would visit him like almost every summer. He was a funny country guy. You know, he loved the fish, loved the hunt, never cursed. He would just say, Jack snap it or darn it. That was as close as he would ever come to cursing. He was, no, he was a man of God, a father, grandfather, husband, and so just the cool person to hang out with. And so when we hung out with him, he didn't want too many people knowing about the invention because he felt disappointed that nothing was done about it. And so the fact came out, you know, he's passed. I know that's a blessing. And I know our family is blessing as well. Yes, definitely.
And that's why I'm also glad you mentioned briefly the Google patents, because other families that may have a similar story as Mr. Bond, they can Google their family's patent and maybe get some movement forward on their invention. Like I said, I think this is so many people's stories, but clearly your grandfather's story is very unique. I would love to see what like a Tyler Perry would do to that story. When I saw what he did with the 6888, I was just like, wow, this, I mean, I always knew he was a great storyteller, but somebody like that of that stature would do very great justice to your grandfather's story. So just wanted to put that out in the atmosphere. You never know who's hearing these conversations.
Definitely. And it's true. You never know, because you never know who's listening. And when you have a person like a Tyler Perry or other actors or even Spike Lee who produce and they want these stories to be told, it's an awesome thing because it's culture, it's life, and it's our history, and that should never be, you know, taken away from us. And there's so many stories like the title, Unsung, where people did things and never got credit. And if you were around my grandpa, you knew there was no animosity. He was never bitter about it. I know he was frustrated, but he lived a life. You know, he owned land, had a house built in 1956. So he still was very productive, and he didn't let that stop him. And that's why I admired was his perseverance, that even despite the racial climate and, you know, the Jim Crow South, he didn't let that stop him or deter him. And that goes to show how people were. But, yeah, that would be great if a producer could be listening like right now and say, okay, Stephen, we'll make a story about this, a documentary. It would just be awesome because many of the family members who are part of it, you know, some of them are not here anymore. You know, my dad passed in 2020. My uncles that he had, I had several of them because my grandfather had 10 sons and one daughter, and he adopted a daughter, him and my grandmother. So, and I put that in the book as well. So with all that, he still supported 12 children, despite being denied in history, where he could have been a billionaire, to say the least, because think about it, every moving vehicle, even like a forklift machine, there's a turn signal, a golf cart. So many moving vehicles have signal lights. And so to think where he could have been, and I even told my students often, I said, Albert Einstein, you know, Oppenheimer, all these famous no inventors. Mm-hmm. I said, listen, respectfully, they had nothing on my grandfather, David George Bach. So he was a genius, to say the least, definitely.
He was definitely a remarkable man, for sure, and he's going to get his just due credit. I really can feel it, especially in this upcoming year. I want to talk about you, though, not to disrespect your grandfather, but you are a great man in your own right. With all of the things that you've been working on, you've written several books. You've had some major life transitions, and, you know, you've also stepped into the world of public speaking. I know you text me or called me a couple of months ago, and you was telling me that you were going to be featured as a speaker on the Black Education or Black Ed Summit Real Talk. This was back in October, I think.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So for anyone that's not familiar with that event, I think it's like a conference for Black educators, right, and advocates and folks who are community leaders in Delaware. But you were invited to be a speaker to that. Tell us a little bit about that and how that came about.
Now, that was awesome. It's a friend and colleague of mine who started. His name is Darren Rainey, and he's worked at Delaware State. And he asked me to be one of the speakers, and it was just a great one-day conference. They had several speakers. And Dr. Yolanda Ruiz, I don't know if you've heard of her. She's an amazing educator. She was the head speaker. And they had several teachers, student leaders, just talk about different topics, like in history, like unsung in history, just historical figures. And the topic I spoke on was the topic of teaching topics such as riots, assassination, and massacres, because a lot of people are intrigued by history. However, when you teach certain topics like massacres, like, you know, most of us now know about the Tulsa Massacre, but they hid that from people for years. When you teach about the different assassinations of, like, of Malcolm X or Fred Hampton and a lot of civil rights leaders, even Martin Luther King, there's a certain way you want to teach it where you want to keep it compelling, interesting, but sometimes there has to be a sensitivity because I know some states teachers been doing reenactments. Like one teacher in Florida did a reenactment of a little girl in elementary school having handcuffs like Rosa Parks when she's arrested. And, you know, some things you'll think make sense, but people don't do it. One lady did like a reenactment of, which is crazy, of course, of Jewish people being sent to the crematories and ovens during the Holocaust. So in my workshop, I was basically telling other teachers and other leaders some of the best ways and methods on how to teach the massacres and assassinations. Like, don't show bias. Let the students hear the facts and let them think for themselves what went on, you know. And that's the best way of doing it, because many times we bring our emotions into it. But especially with children and young people, you let them hear the story, you give them the facts, you let them think about how it went down or what's their view, and take from there. So that what I did the professional development on. And one thing that's dear to my heart, I do professional developments on social-emotional learning of teachers and students, because many times students, now more than ever, you have to reach them emotionally, because kids go through more trauma than I think our generation went through. So many times we have to listen to students more. I let students journal how they feel, what they're thinking about. And you'd be surprised if they write sometimes. You know, kids will say what's going on in their life that's going good, what's bothering them, if they're depressed, if they're struggling. Mm-hmm. And that's really how my first book was started, because back when COVID ended, you know, school physically, and it's a virtual, a lot of students were downtrodden and depressed, and just they were struggling. And so I told the students, journal like we normally would in class. Like, we'd have Mental Health Monday where first 10 minutes of class, write down how you feel. Write it, text it, email it to me, keep it confidential, but let me know how you feel. And so...
You didn't get any pushback from that?
Actually, I didn't. The students were more than welcome to do it, and my director knew, and so I think they're surprised by it, and so I kept it going. And so when they would sometimes text it to me or email it to me during COVID, and I said to myself, wow, this should be written, because I had so many intimate journal students saying how tough was the COVID. I had one girl, and her name was Lauren, and most of the kids, you know, I still talk talk to, correspond with. Matt, I'm trying to see if we could, like, maybe do, like, part two of it. And Lauren talked about how, you know, her mom's a nurse and how she came to hug when she gets home from work because she might pass COVID to her. She had family members with heart issues, and if they get COVID, what would happen to them? Those students lost their prom. We were supposed to go to Disney that year. So a lot of normalcies of a senior year, they couldn't do. And I never forget that one young lady, and it was amazing. We did like a drive-through graduation that year, and, you know, they were supposed to get their diplomas, well, drive up, get the diploma, and then drive away. And what young lady did, and frankly, nobody was upset. She got out her van, and she hugged every teacher that she had. And we were not going to deny that. I mean, why not? The girl's in tears, and she was the one that, she was a very sweet young lady. She would hug her teachers and just say, no, I appreciate you. And so we let her do it. So a lot of kids were traumatized with COVID. You know, just something simple, going to the mall, going out to eat, or some kids had jobs, and they lost their jobs because you work at a restaurant and COVID's happening. They lost work.
Right.
And so
they had
a lot,
the rug pulled from under them completely.
They sure did. They sure did. And so seven wrote journals, and for some did it for days, some did it for weeks. And I put as much as I could into the book because I wanted the people to see how the kids were feeling, how they were struggling, and how, you know, venting about it helped them emotionally. But also, as teachers, we need to see that, okay, kids going through things that we may not be aware of. And so I'm so glad that this book was a picture on what kids are going through. And I think, you know, that spectrum, when it was opened up, you have more of sympathy and understanding for kids. And that's that social-emotional learning, which, you know, now teachers are doing it more, but I think it needs to be incorporated even more. And most of the kids who I taught from that year have either graduated college or finished up college. And, you know, when I see them or what they see me on Instagram, I tell them I'm so proud of them. And so it's just awesome. Like, I know one young man, he's at St. Augustine's in North Carolina. He's a senior. And one actually told me that they graduated from college in a week and a half in December. And so from UNC Greensboro. So I'm truly proud of them, how they persevered through COVID. Because it was a struggle for adults. So imagine if you're a 15- and 16-year-old kid, how tough it is to have to navigate through all that and not going to school, not having a teacher help you, trying to do things online or on Zoom. And there'll be sometimes kids will just say, I can't do it today. I don't want to open up the Zoom. I don't want to try to do this. I just need a minute.
Right. It was a lot. And, you know, so I'm glad that you kind of stepped in and kind of went outside of the curriculum and invited them to journal, invited them to talk about their emotions. Because I don't know many teachers at that time, like you said, there may be a lot more who are doing it now. But back then, certainly, I'm sure you were an outcast. I'm just glad that you didn't get a lot of pushback from the students, from the fellow faculty, the administrators. And I'm just glad that you were able to at least give some of those students an outlet, because everything that they had going on was just turned upside down. And then you had the fear of the pandemic, and no one knew what was going on, and it was a lot of misinformation and disinformation. Now school is turned up on its head. Everybody's logging into Zoom and trying to learn how to be virtual. It was just a lot, those poor kids.
It was a lot. And truth be told, during Zoom, no one wants to admit this, but there was not a lot of learning going on during Zoom. Many times I would be on the Zoom. Sometimes kids had their cameras on. Sometimes they wouldn't. But sometimes what I would just do is say, listen, take the first 10 minutes of the Zoom to journal and vent how you feel. And sometimes they'll email it to me. So they were hurt, they were mad, and they just, the big question was, which most of them had, was why this, why now, where all these other students years before, they had regular graduation, regular school years, and now they didn't. And what it also did, I think that another topic, and we're going to talk about it later, of course, is that people, well, parents, a lot of them took teachers for granted. You know, when COVID hit and the kids weren't learning, a lot of parents were now saying, wow, what that teacher did matter. We may not care before, but now we see how the tempers they have, the patience they have, the demeanor they have, and the heart of teaching is so important. And COVID showed it to a lot of people at that point. Because many times, as you know, our job is unsung. We get ignored. We get disrespected. We don't get too much praise for what we do. But in our job, we're empowering young people to become the doctors, lawyers, teachers, and leaders of this world. And many times, we do not get the props that we definitely deserve.
That's absolutely true. And actually, I want to talk more about that when we come back from the break about what forms of support and reform that you would like to see, or maybe that's already been put in place. We'll talk about that when we get back. But it just sounds like everything that you've been doing, your experience in the classroom, what you just talked about with the COVID era, it just highlighted something that we often overlook, and it's that not just our teachers, our students as well, but definitely our teachers are carrying a lot of burdens that than just trying to figure out what the lesson plan is going to be. And that's right. Why I love this book, this new book that you wrote, because it goes right to the heart of that. And we're going to dig into that when we come back from the break. But let's do this. Let's take a brief commercial break. Everybody, don't go anywhere, because when we come back, we're going to talk about Dr. Bond's new book called Suffering in Bleak Silence and the emotional journey that inspired that book. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to Live with Dr. Andre Gerry.
Hi, I'm James Baller of Artist First Radio, and I would like to tell you about a fascinating new book from Crime Beat's Ron Chepsik and co-author Mike Rowe. It's titled Robin Hood of the Hood, The Life and Times of Teddy Rowe, Policy Kingpin, and it's published by Strategic Media Books. The book is a historical account of Theodore Teddy Rowe, who courageously fought the Chicago Mafia, more commonly known as the Outfit, for control of the lucrative policy racket in the Windy City. Policy, often called the numbers, is a form of illegal gambling or illegal lottery, played mostly in poor and working-class neighborhoods in the United States. In policy, a bettor attempts to pick three digits to match those that will be randomly drawn the following day. For decades, policy had been a staple in the black community, but when the white mob flexed its power in the late 1940s, many policy kings knuckled under the pressure. Not Teddy Rowe. Rowe famously told mob bosses that he'd rather die than give up control of his operation. Robin Hood of the Hood chronicles an exciting chapter of Chicago history. Go to the Kindle store at Amazon and buy it for just $2.99. For information about this book and other titles, please go to strategicmediabooks.com. That's strategicmediabooks.com.
Looking for your next car? Amazon Autos has you covered. With just a few clicks, you can shop a wide selection of new vehicles, compare prices, read reviews, and even arrange pickup or delivery, just like ordering anything else on Amazon. It's the future of car buying. Simple, transparent, and all online. Backed by Amazon's trusted network and partnering with local dealerships, Amazon Autos is redefining how we shop for cars. Visit amazon.com/autos and drive into the future today.
Welcome to another broadcast of Spiritual Concerns, the Deborah Ruffini Show on Artist First Radio Network. We're live from England on Saturdays and Sundays, 3 p.m. New York, 8 p.m. London. All past shows are podcasts. Find them at artistfirst.com. I'll be your host, where issues relating to spiritual matters of concern will be largely examined and discussed. Enjoy the show.
You're back live with Dr. Andre Gerry.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Hey, if you're just joining us, we're here with esteemed educator and best-selling author, Dr. Stephen Bond. Before the break, we talked about the emotional weight that many educators carry. It's far beyond what the world sees or largely what we talk about. But now we're going to turn our attention to his powerful new book called Suffering in Bleak Silence, A Teacher's Mental Health Struggles Exposed. And I was chuckling a little bit because we were talking about during the break how you noticed where, you know, instance or two where teachers would come into work inebriated or, you know, on alcohol or drugs or stuff like that. And I chuckled because I if I was a teacher, I know I would definitely be one of those teachers that came to work with a bottle. I just know I would. But, yeah, this is really a great conversation because I really have not heard a lot of conversations about what
daily struggles teachers deal with. We're always talking about the students and are the students getting what they need and do they have the resources they need and all this type of stuff, but we never really talk about the teachers. What are they carrying and what are they going home with? So that's why I want to talk about the heart of this new project, this new book that you wrote, because like I said, this isn't your first publication. You published a number of books, but I want to talk about what the moment was or the series of moments that made you realize this was the story you needed to tell next.
You know, it's interesting. About a couple months ago, it came to me, like, I've seen for years where teachers were struggling mentally and people see it. Sometimes they don't, and they just ignore it. Like, I've seen teachers, like, have panic attacks in a classroom. Teachers deal with high blood pressure, anxiety, all type of things. And many times we get unnoticed or it's like no one cares. We go through somebody teaching these kids because most teachers, I would say 99% of teachers, they care about their students and do the work every day. But we deal with kids' attitudes, parents' attitudes, administrative attitudes, and it becomes much, too much sometimes. You know, if a kid cusses you out, fusses you out, you still got to teach them. You just want them to do the work, and then they try to make it personal, or then the parent is complaining, and they just assume it's you have something against a child, when in reality, you just want the child to learn. It's a lot, and lesson plans, administrative work, all this, it compiles. And many times, people think we got the easy job, or you have summers so off, you do this, you do that, where in reality, the 10 months work we do is so much. And a psychologist actually did research and said a teacher makes more, has to make more quick decision than even a surgeon. Like, we make about 1,000 decisions in one whole day. We see a child that has a need. What do we do? What approach do we need to learn? What approach can help? Then another student is misbehaving. You have to tell them to be quiet, or another kid has their phone out, and that's a whole nother topic. One kid trying to write something, they need help. And so there's so many things going on at one time, and we're pouring into everybody, the administrator, the parents, the students, and most of the time, no one's pouring into us. And if you work in schools where a fight occurs, one of the most stressful things is when a fight occurs and you're breaking up a fight. And I've had break up a few fights in my day. So those who have had me as a teacher, you know how Dr. Bond, the Coach Bond was. And after that, it's hard to teach because the kids are hyped up with adrenaline. You're hyped with adrenaline. You're thinking, like, nobody's learning anything today.
So no, those are things we deal with. Fight back in the day. Once a fight happened, or if even a talk of a fight happened, that's all we could. We couldn't focus on learning. And
exactly.
Let the fight actually happen. No, the day is over with. That's all anybody going to want to talk about after is that fight and who got whooped and who did. And so it's just, you know, as a teacher, you have to care. I don't know who would get in this industry and not care. I know there are good teachers and bad teachers, but who signs up for this, being a security guard and breaking up fights and being a psychologist? Who signs up for all of this if you don't really care and have a heart for those children whose needs, all their needs are different? They all learn differently. They all have different things going on at home. You know, it's just a lot. I don't know who signs up for that type of work if you don't care about those kids and how they learn and what they learn.
I totally agree. I don't see how you can be a teacher and not love what you do, because then it's not your DNA, because the teachers, we're counselors, we're psychologists, we're the therapist, we're the lawyer, we're the negotiator, we're the compromiser, we're the mom, we're the dad, we're the stepdad. It's all that, because many times we spend more time with those students than their own parents do. I remember one time I had a principal that did not like me, and she tried to observe me, and there was going to be a school dance, like, late at night. And so it's one of the things where, you know, bump the lesson plan. All the kids think about was a dance. A couple of kids were like, well, Dr. Bond, can you show my tie a tie? And so it's a teachable moment. I taught three young men how to tie a tie. One boy was on the spectrum, and he was like, how'd you ask a girl out? And we was helping him. He was a smooth dude. We helped him. And he was so happy. And so sometimes it's beyond the lesson plan. We were helping the kids so much. you know, nobody wanted to hear history that day. They said, well, the dance is happening in a couple hours. And so, will so-and-so say yes to me? Am I going to have fun? Can you help me do the cha-cha slide? Can you help me do the wobble? It's all types of questions. So what did I do? I said, listen, I'm going to put the YouTube on. And I showed the kids, okay, this is how you do the wobble. This is how you stay in rhythm. I said, no, stay in rhythm. This is why you got to listen. But sometimes it's beyond the lesson plan. And those kids are so happy. So they went and they saw, they did the wobble. I danced with them too. And I never forget, they were playing Lil Jon and Ludacris, singing Yeah. And I was singing Yeah with them. I was like, I was playing this when I was young and in the club in college. And you know, the kids got kicked out. They recorded me dancing and everything. But the amazing part, Doc, was the next day we had class, which was a Monday, they remember that. And so beyond the books, beyond the lesson plans, beyond all that, not just learn the wobble, not just learn the Lil Jon songs, but the point was that they saw a connection with the teacher. And so we go through because we have so many hats we wear. And sometimes what happens is the teachers, you get tired because we do so much compromise. We break up fights before they start. We stop the gossip because, oh, so-and-so looking at so-and-so man, now somebody pop off and we got to talk to the kids and say no. Or they'll ask for advice with relationships or things like that. So there's so many things we do, and it's draining. And do we still got to get observed? We got to do lesson plans, paperwork, all these things. We go to meetings even with you don't feel like it. Oh, we got a meeting today at 3 after class. Now we got a meeting tomorrow and a meeting next day. And then you say, well, Doc, what was the meeting about when you went there yesterday? It's like you get to the point where it's like, okay, my brain's an overload. I don't remember what they talked about in the meeting. And those who are listening to this, who are educators, know exactly what I'm talking about.
You get, you know, you guys give so much of yourself. Yeah. It's like you're always on. And so I can understand how you would be drained at the end of the day. And then what are you going to give to yourself and your family? You're definitely not going to the gym after all of that. So that leads to all lots of stuff. You know, you're getting out of shape and maybe you're drinking a little bit more because you had such a day. And it's not like one day or two. This is like every day for you guys. And so I can just hear how draining it is, but also rewarding. It's not all bad, you know, because it's a rewarding job too. But Dr. Bunn, at some point, we got to talk about this book now. Okay.
Yes, definitely.
Let me tell you what I love about this book. Let me just tell you what I love about it, because, of course, when you asked me to write the foreword to it, you sent me an advanced copy. What I love about this book is that the reader is first introduced to the protagonist or the main character through his journal entries. Yes. And I thought that was a brilliant way to sort of bring people in, engage the reader, and get them immersed into the story. I'm not going to give too much away for those who haven't purchased their copy yet, but the way this is written, it makes you become kind of emotionally attached to the characters. I remember when I was reading, I was texting you in real time about my responses. Some of those characters pissed me off. One of the little boys I wanted to fight. I'm like, okay, now, come on. You know, and then one of the administrators, he had some stuff going on. I was like, look, this is not right. You know, so it's a very emotional story. You get caught up into it from the very first page because it starts off with a journal entry. So you're just immediately drawn in. So I love that about the book. And like I said, I went from hating one of the characters to at the end, he was one of my favorite characters during the end. And so I just love the way you put all this together and, you know, the way you gave us a raw glimpse into the dark side of teaching. And, you know, so I just wanted to give you your props on that. My question is, what made you use that particular method of telling the story, that narrative style? Was that purpose-driven, or did you kind of repurpose some journals that you actually had, or how did you come about that at all?
You know, what's interesting about that, you're like the third person to ask me that. I did the journal style because I know me as a thinker. I may not journal everything, but that's how I think sometimes, and I want people to really feel the protagonist, the teacher named Jared. I want people to feel how he felt, how he was struggling but trying to hold it together. So he's at the new school. He's getting punked. He's getting disrespected. And it's just a whole lot going on. And so one of the things in the story, because, you know, I don't want to tell the whole story, but he gets injured for trying to break up a fight, and it leads to a downhill spiral. And I know, and also one of the characters who was another teacher went through something, that person went through where I remember I was breaking up a fight one time. This was a few years ago. And before I got to it, it was like in the gym, and this kid was getting beat up really bad. Like, he got punched about 5-6 times in his eye. And I pushed the other kid away from him and stopped it at that point. So I get home. I get a phone call from his grandmother. And first of all, I'm thinking, how in the world did she get my cell phone number? And she's yelling at me and saying, Dr. Bond, my son came home with a black eye, and he said you caused it. He said you hit him in the eye when you trying to break the fight and this and that. I said, ma'am, wait a minute. I said, first off, your son was cursing the kid out, and I saw the kid punching him. I saw the kid punch him in the eye at least 5 times, and when I finally moved him away, that's what caused it. And then at first she didn't believe me, and he wanted to tell the truth. And then he finally told the truth, basically said to his grandmother, I ain't want to let you know that I got my butt whipped by that boy.
Oh.
And yes. And so the grandma's upset because she said, why are you lying on Bond like that? Because that could have started something up. And so it bothered me. It was stressful for me that the kid would lie to try to save face.
Did the parent apologize, come back and apologize?
No. No.
Oh,
not at all.
I would have cut
not at all. I know the boy felt guilty, but there's no apology. And so those are the things we go through as educators where you're trying to help. And like we're being a superhero to try to help save this boy from getting even more bodily harm. But now to save face, he lies and makes it seem like I did something wrong. Those are the stressful things. Or when a principal may just not like to teach for whatever reason, may not like their teaching style or personality, and you fight getting picked on. These are the stresses we go through. You just have that class that just want to listen and want to, you know, curse teachers out and be disrespectful. And so those are things we deal with often. And so when you compile that on, teachers get worn out. But the question is, who's pouring into the teachers? Most schools don't have mental health advocates for the teachers. They don't. If the principal see teachers are stressed, if they do see it, what do they do? Would they say, well, have a mental health day or let's do this instead? Most of those things are not accessible for teachers. So we suffer and struggle in silence, as the book says, and we're still trying to work, and we're like in survival mode saying like, okay, let me just get through this day. Let me get through this class period. Oh, crap. First period is awful. Let me get through fifth period. Okay, gosh, somebody threw a marble at somebody. Oh, gosh, let me call admin. Let me call security. Gosh, there's still 25 minutes left in this class. Like, okay, this is the slowest time I've ever seen. And so then you're looking, it's 5 minutes left in the class. That 5 minutes seems like 38 and a half minutes. So many times, like I said, it is a fight, it's a battle, and a struggle. And then you start to call parents to say, well, Johnny has an A or Giant has a D. Well, why did Johnny have a D? Did he miss the assignments? And then you'll say, yes, I text you or emailed you before what he didn't or didn't do. And so we have to have our ducks in a row and have our behinds covered, or if not, they'll try to hold us accountable.
Right.
And then we're the ones getting in trouble. And that's why so many leave the profession. And some of the other statistics, like only 1.3% of teachers are black male. So obviously that discrepancy is due, racism is one of the reasons. And so there's so many things. And many teachers leave the profession because they see money-wise, your first starting off is not that much. Now, the veteran teachers make a little bit more, but for the most part, it's like the end doesn't justify the mean. Like, I'm going through all this social and emotional toil and abuse and fatigue. And you're saying, for what? Why am I going through all this? Is it worth it? And sometimes it's why the profession, to keep the sanity. And so with this book, I hope this book raises awareness that people respect teachers, but also see if they're struggling, that they may need mental health days off, that they do need help, that their load is beyond carrying. And it's not realistic that anyone can carry the burden that teachers go through daily. It could be elementary, middle, or high school. It's a lot. And so many teachers are burnt out and frustrated and tired, especially because we don't feel supported. And that's one of the major issues, the lack of support from the top.
Right. For people who are listening, when you get this book, that's one of the first things that's going to stand out to you is just how much our teachers endure behind the scenes. We talk about all the stuff that they have to do, breaking up fights and getting cursed out by the students and the teachers and the parents. You know, like I was mentioning before, we always talk about how the students are getting bullied. The teachers are getting bullied. And it's just, there's a lot going on. And I remember one thing you told me, I think it was in your last show, you were telling me how we already talked about how there are not a lot of black male teachers out there. But when you're a black male teacher and you're really good and you're beloved by the kids, you can get hated on by some of the members of your own faculty.
Yes, you can. And I've experienced that before. Because many times the black male teachers, and I know there's been doctor work on this and research done on this, research shows that when you have a African-American male teacher, the likelihood you're going to college and graduate high school is higher. And many times, you know, the reality is we had to work harder for our degrees. We had to work hard for where we are. And many times we tend to have connection that's beyond the X's and O's, or besides the lesson plans. Like, yes, we're hearing to lesson plans, but we may teach things outside the box. For me, like, one of the things I've always done as a teacher, I incorporate music. So if I'm teaching history from any era, I'll incorporate music from that era, like from the 1950s or the 60s. And every time I teach, like, the 70s or 80s and 90s, I love music from those eras, I will play the disco from the 70s, I'll play the music from the 60s with the Vietnam War, and I'll play the song War Wasn't Good For, and you watch the Rush Hour movies with Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker. Most of the kids love that song. I'll play it. I'll play a lot of the anthems from, like, Public Enemy. I'm actually friends with Chuck D from Public Enemy, so we'll play Fight the Power. Mm-hmm. We'll play the different songs of that era. And so many times, we as educators, we reach the kids by being different. You're not just going to just teach from the textbook and say, read this for 50 minutes, and no, kids get bored. But incorporating the music, sometimes I incorporate the music of Tupac and even his poetry book. And so what you're doing with that is you're making history not just a boring story, but you're making it an interesting and intriguing and compelling story. And those are things which, one reason which motivate kids to learn. Now, sometimes I've seen where it does cause, like, sometimes a little ruffling of feathers or even jealousy, but, you know, you do what you got to do as a teacher. And so many times you have that camaraderie and relationship with that kid. And sometimes when others see you have a strong rapport with the students, there's a jealousy. I remember when, and this did happen to me in real life, and this is in my epilogue, I found my twin sister passed while I was in the classroom. And the group I had, bless their heart, that was a group that made teachers almost quit. That group, I loved them. They could be a little loud sometimes, but they loved my class. They loved my history class. Most teachers they did not like, but that group could be annoying. And so I get a call from a policeman, and I'm like, wait, what's this about? I'm like, I paid that traffic ticket from like 4 or 5 years ago, so I hope this ain't the problem. So they stop me and say, your twin sister passed out in front of your dad. My dad had dementia. Being with dementia, he was able to call 911 to say, something bad happened. I don't remember, but something bad is going on. So he forgot my sister passed out. So the police had told me to the phone, they say my twin sister passed. And I lost it. I cried in the classroom. And the kids were like, in class, like, Doc, what's going on? As they affectionately called me. And I said, my twin passed. And most of the kids in that class knew I had a twin sister. I would talk about her. I told about I used to protect her when we go to school in New York. And I had a girl in that class who was a twin. And so I ran out the classroom. Don't remember much. All I know is I remember driving to see my dad. And so I remember most of the kids DM me, found me or something, and said, email me and said, Dr. Bond, we are so sorry for losing your twin. We are praying for you. We are here for you. We appreciate you. We love you. And so we had that rapport with students. They showed they really care. And most of the time, the kids, even with the issues they may deal with, the struggles, the emotional trauma they've dealt with, many times they connect with the teacher. There's not much they won't do for them. And writing this book, I was inspired to write it because when I went through that trauma of losing a twin, then a couple months later, lose my dad, and all those things, I was still trying to teach, and I had to just drop and say, listen, I need a break. I'm trying to do too much. And most teachers, especially effective ones, we're always helping everybody. But many times, we don't take time for ourselves. And I learned that myself, and that's why I wrote this book, because if any teachers in that situation, get help. Don't worry if they complain about you taking days off. Take the day off. If they're saying, oh, well, you're late with this, you're late with that. And next question. But being more in charge of your mental health, taking control and charge is so important these days. And that's one of the main reasons why I wrote this book, because I love education. I do. And even in the story, the teacher loved to educate. He was that teacher who, if kids were hungry, he fed them. Most teachers I know, a kid's hungry, they're going to get something. They're going to find something for that kid to eat. We that's how we are.
That's right.
We're almost, that's how we are. And so we're like almost those superheroes, just unsung. And so we will stop what we do to make sure a kid has something. Well, this boy didn't have breakfast. Well, let's get him breakfast. This didn't happen. I remember one time they had an event in the school, and they wanted the kids to bring some food. And the boy just said, my parents have money for me to participate for the party. So what do we do as teachers? We make sure the kid has something. So that's what we do. And many times it goes unnoticed, sometimes forgotten. But that kid, 10, 20 years later, those kids will remember it. I have students who I taught even 27 years ago when I started teaching. They remember me, the stuff I did in class, but more importantly, they remember the lessons and values and how
I
was there
for them. You always remember a good teacher.
That's so
even
true.
If it was second grade, fifth grade, you're going to remember that teacher who left and made an impact on your life in a positive way. You'll remember when you're 40, 50, 60 years old. It never fails.
Definitely, definitely. Even I can remember the teacher that inspired me. I had a teacher, Joseph Mayer, and I think he's still alive in Freeport, New York. He was the first teacher that said I was smart. He put me in honest science because he said I could do it, and I first thought it would be too hard. And he said, no, you got this, and he inspired me like no teacher had before. And in undergrad, I had a professor, and we still talk to this day, and they were Dr. Arby Bonet. And he said, not only are you going to graduate, but I definitely going to graduate school and doing big things in your life. And that stuck with me. And even after I graduated from undergrad, and it's been 26 years, we still talk. And I told him one day, I said, Doc, you were one of the people who inspired me being educated. And he just texted me the other day and said, Doc, I need a copy of that book and I need an autograph, please. No exceptions. So so we are inspired by educators as well, and it's just such an awesome feeling.
Well, Dr. Bond, I'm so glad that you came on. We've run out of time for this episode, but this has been an incredibly important conversation. I really appreciate you writing this book, the transparency, the courage, and, you know, just shining a light on the emotional reality that our teachers are going through. Because, you know, you wrote a powerful story, but you also live this work. You've advocated, you've educated beyond, you know, what you are asked to do or supposed to do. So I just really want to thank you for everything that you've done in this industry. To everyone that's listening tonight, you know, whether you're an educator, a parent, a policymaker, it doesn't matter. My hope is that this conversation gives you, you know, a reason to check in on the teachers in your life. If you have a family member that's a teacher, check in on them. Thank the teachers that are teaching your children, your nieces, your nephews. Give them support and not just expectations. You know, so again, Dr. Bond, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I'm sorry we didn't have more time, but definitely come back and give us an update on that documentary, because I know that's coming down the pipeline soon.
Well, thank you, and thank you for allowing me to be on your show. I appreciate all you do and continue even for more. And thank you again.
Thank you. And until next time, I'm Dr. Andre Geary. This has been Live with Dr. Andre Geary. Good night, everybody.